listen to Six Music on the BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest is the singer with a band who emerged in the wake of the grunge explosion of the early 90s, but unlike the other major players in the genre, they were British. And in fact, they were arguably the first and biggest British grunge band, selling over 20 million records worldwide and earning my guest an Ivor Novello Award for International Achievement. His band are also rare in that they avoided imploding. Apart from a hiatus from 2002 to 2010, they've been a constant presence and continue to release big records and sell out big places and hold a very special place in the hearts of many. I'm very happy to welcome to The First Time from Bush, Gavin Rossdale. And you just heard Bush with the track Everything Zen from their 1994 breakthrough album 16 Stone. Sounds good, that, right? In this chat, we dig into Gavin's earliest musical influences and some of the seminal gigs that he went to in his youth. We also look at this idea that Bush and Gavin, who appeared to be like the perfect rock frontman, that they emerged fully formed out of nowhere, ready to fill stadiums. That's pretty far from the truth. The route to global success was a lot harder than maybe it appeared from the outside. Likewise, Gavin's musical passions have always run deep into the left field, and we chat about working with acclaimed Pixies producer Steve Albini on Bush's Razorblade Suitcase album. And we cover how it feels when you reach the incredible levels of US fame that Gavin experienced, the impact of that on your private life and the pressures that come with keeping creative momentum under that much scrutiny. But I started by asking Gavin, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
My parents had they were married for the first part of my life, and they had a small record collection, but it was like hearing Roberta Flack or something like that, just hearing music. I think that's always what I think about the melodies, because my parents had about like five albums. It was like Roberta Flack, Queen, Marvin Gaye.
This is a good grounding though, right?
Well, you know what I did is it, like, no matter how much I love guitars, and I really, really love guitars, and I love detuned guitars, and I like exciting riffs, stuff like that, I'm always chasing melody. To me, that's the magic of music.
Was music regarded as kind of a special thing in the house? Was it like, oh, we're putting on a record now, or was it just around on the radio and stuff?
You know, I don't have those lovely stories of, like, you know, great history of, like, you know, and then I listened to Mozart, and then I moved on to Elgar and stuff like that. Those, like, five records were on sometimes. I remember because my dad had signed it to my mum. So it was a sort of a rare moment of a sweetness that I wasn't aware of, you know, as you go, yeah, whatever, you know, later on. So it was a nice thing that I saw that, and it was a Killing Me Softly record. So I just always love those melodies.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style. And so I came to see him to listen for a while. And there he was, this young boy, a stranger to my eyes, strumming my fate with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song.
And where did you find music that was yours? You've talked a lot about there's a kind of famous record shop in your history.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
But when did you first hear something on the radio or see something on telly and just go, that's not for them, this is for
that's
me.
The beauty. That's Top of the Pops, you know, Top of the Pops was where it was at. And sitting down every week to watch that and to escape your parents, basically, escape your life. And what could that be? It was just like a world of potential for me. I never thought I could actually make music at the time, but I just thought it was sort of, it was like a dreamy magic carpet out of here, like a lifeboat away from stuff, that when you could see these people singing and playing, just were convinced that they had the better life.
Was there a performance you remember distinctly?
Bohemian Rhapsody, as a kid, seeing that was a lot on. That was probably the one that was really the most. And that was weird, because then they got my mum involved, all around the TV watching it. Right. Normally, this, it was a bit of escapism on Top of the Pops. But that brought it back round.
Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia.
Mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me.
When punk hit, do we go Pistols, do we go X-Ray Specs? Where do we go?
I fell in love with the Sex Pistols, and I found God Save the Queen gave me a headache. And I remember playing it going, you've got to like this, because this is the revolution. This is it, boy. This is here we're going.
So you were aware that this was something tangibly different?
Because that was when it was all kicking off. It was perfect for me. It was a real revolution of like social changing the status quo, where just people couldn't believe these outrageous people. And I was just a kid with an older sister who was into all that.
Always good having an elder sibling.
Yeah, really, and does. She was super into punk, had all the punk friends. And so it was just a brilliant, brilliant ride. I mean, for me, it's that Malcolm Gladwell thing, of those sort of lovely happenstance things, you know, to be around, be young enough to sort of experience punk when it was like, it was a revolution, to have the older sister who had the boyfriend with the band that gave me the bass. You know, that I carried around. I'd, you know, go to these like really terrible rehearsal rooms, stinky, damp, dark, cold, and I loved them. And so I would carry them, you know, sort of help them out, carry guitars in and out of
that. Oh, you were that little kid that was like, help with the bass amp, mate.
Yeah. But it was the band at the time called the Nobodies. It was brilliant, and nobody did it. They had a Z at the end, so it's pretty impressive. But it was just getting that taste of it. Yeah, so music was beginning to get important to me around that time. X-Ray Specs was my first. I mean, that Germ-Free Adolescence, that record, Genetic Engineering, I listened to it recently, and the lyrics are brilliant. Styrene. I actually had met her at a retreat. She became Hare Krishna. I did love The Clash. I know you meant to choose between the two, but it was all a bit good, The Clash. I way preferred the first record to Give Them Enough Rope. That sort of, when I got the Give Them Enough Rope, that sort of wasn't Tommy Gunn. I like that, but the first record was just like out of control. So that was really, really big record for me. I liked them both, but I know what you mean. It's like Beatles or Stones. That'd be Beatles.
Why did you think punk resonated with you as a kid at that age? Were you looking for something to kick against?
I think that it's to do with right at that time. That's just my parents and I, they were together and they got divorced when I was 11, 12. And my mum moved away for a couple of years. So, and that was a time of no therapy or no reflection. You just had to like deal with it. So I think punk spoke to my trauma. Not that I would ever say that word. I apologize for that word. But all the bad stuff and all the things I had witnessed, all the way adults let you down as a kid, they mount up. And punk was this brilliant release of anger and energy. And the best part is you didn't have to be that articulate about it. It was just a feeling. And that, weirdly enough, that thread has carried through all the way to making the record now. That sort of making sure that anger is in there, or that sort of that well of information for songwriting is in there.
What was your very first band? And please let them have a really awful name, because I really like those early bands with the
yeah.
names.
Oh, I'll tell you a good one.
Go on.
I was in a band, the first band I was in, which did get signed. I didn't get a chance to make a record, but I made a couple of singles, and it was called Midnight. It was just a boring name because it was like decent, sort of like a chocolate box or something. But the best one, we did have an interim name before we became Midnight. It was so brilliant because I went to my stepmom's house last night to see her and went through my room, and she gave me a couple of cassettes of the demos of the very first band before it was called Midnight, and it was called Final Echo.
Oh,
so good, right? It's awful, right? And the best thing is, we were on a tour. We did a short tour with a band called Auto Da Fe. Do you know this Irish band? We did a tour of pubs in rural Ireland. And I remember having a really good gig. I cannot imagine what it sounded like or what it was, because I know we got through it. But the best one, so this band, Final Echo, and they liked it so much, they're going, last echo, last echo. We're like, no. And I was just telling that story yesterday to my kids. I was like, this is the worst name ever for a band. And not only that, people got it wrong and I had to correct them during the show. It's like, you know, 100 people, you know, drunk in Ireland somewhere. It was brilliant. It was so funny. But thank you for yeah, so bad. It's like, oh, void of just nothing about it. No merit to that one. I don't know why I thought that.
So another first would be like, I mean, the first rehearsal that you did with Bush. Because normally when I speak to musicians, that first rehearsal with the kind of breakthrough band, people are either like, we knew there was something there straight away. We could tell. We just looked at each other and we were like, yeah, this is. Or it's people going, we were shocking. We were shocking for ages.
Yeah.
Which of those two camps?
Well, I'll tell you this, how good we were. Well, my friend Sasha, who played with me in every band, Sasha Putnam, still my best friend, and he was in the first two bands, then he left when I began Bush to go and study, and then when he came back, I hired him as the keyboard player. So my first rehearsal with him, he was like, why are you standing in the corner, like, singing? I said, I think it sounds better in the corner. So it's just like, I had no idea about anything. I was just finding my way. I was just bluffing. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Life is generally so much bluff.
Oh, yeah.
It's so much bluffing. That's what's important, to keep trying things and going for stuff, because who's to know anything, really? It's just, it's a funny journey. I decided I should be a singer. It wasn't like I opened my mouth and sang in my room and was like, people need this. Man, I was too dumb to think like that. I was much more like, if I do this, I don't have to do that. And if I do this, if I write songs and I try and be in a band, I can have this like amazing life where I jet out of here and I just go on this journey. It's insane how flippant those life decisions are, you know, and you just make these choices. And I was just so committed to it that I think I just struggled for some time to sound good. So in answer to your question, I was always a work in progress. And it was weird because once I found my voice, literally, it was an interesting thing that in turn became the most recognizable thing about the band at that time, mm-hmm. you know? And David Byrne always says, like, the more better someone sings, the less he trusts them. So he trusted me a lot.
Because there is that thing, and I'm generalising hugely there with singers. It's like, look at me, don't look at me. No, really, look at me, because I'm giving you some, but also don't, I really don't. That's, do you exist in that world?
Yeah, of course, that duality. And it's also that thing of confidence and lack of confidence. I think that's what makes people interesting. And I can't imagine being, because then you would have no sense of doubt within you, you know? That's not good for someone who's creative. You've got to have an ability to sort of think, actually, maybe I'm not right. Maybe that isn't right. You know? So yeah, it is a funny job to want to sing and complain or be plaintive. And I sing in a really plaintive way. You know, I try to reach the full potential by the time I'm given my main idea. Then I'm going back to sort of half the idea, why I'm getting there. It's sort of sinewy and hopefully melodic. Yeah, that dichotomy, you know, that duality, I think it's what exists in all of us that makes us interesting and human and vulnerable. And the idea of being sort of, there are many people I see outwardly as self-assured, but they're so self-assured that I'm thinking, God, you must be a gibbering wreck when you're at home.
Pixies. When did you first hear the Pixies? And what track should we play?
Bone Machine. Trade in Notting Hill and always going to record stores and dreaming of being good enough to be on 4AD.
Was that a big thing for you?
Yeah, well, like throwing muses and so. Or the 4AD, the label was just so brilliant. So going to those record stores and, you know, Rough Trade and always interesting records. And I remember getting the record. And for me, it still is. I still listen to records with the lyrics. I much prefer to listen to records reading someone's lyrics and really getting into it and giving it the time that they've taken. You know, it doesn't take very long to listen to what someone's worked on for a long time. So opening it up and all that artwork and the flamenco girl and the dancer. And then when I put it on and it felt like, I mean, I was a bit lazy. So it sort of felt a bit like this saved my life in the sense that I'd been listening to Pill, The, we're talking about them, Gang of Four. They're all cool bands. But a lot of the rock music that was really emphatic, you know, the kind of the American stuff, Guns N' Roses, all that sort of hair metal, it was all like screaming and really high, and I just sort of didn't really connect to that. But when I heard the Pixies, they just created a different universe, it felt like. It just was so exciting, and it just gave me a sense of the dynamics of rock music and how it could find a way through. Yes, the Pixies were a great
North inspiration. Star.
Yeah, they're a great North Star. And then, you know, like, can't you find your own voice and your own world? And I didn't have Kim Deal because she's an integral part of that to make that whole sound. I think she's my favorite girl singer of all time. And that sound is just something else. We took the Quiet Loud a bit too seriously, but that's what was really fun for crowds, you know. It was really good for crowds.
Was there a moment when you, when Bush kind of clicked for you? One session or one gig when you're like, okay, now this is...
No, I was lying in the bath in my house. I was in the bath.
Wasn't expecting you to say that.
And the other band I'd been in had sort of failed. And so I was in one band that was signed. It was sort of, you know, I right. didn't have anything to do with the music. And then the next band, the Little Dukes, with my friend Emil, who's a great guitar player, amazing rock guitar player. But he didn't want me to play guitar because he, quite rightly, I was terrible. But so when I started to look for someone else to work with, I didn't have anyone else to work with in this, whatever the new band was going to be. And then when I met the guitar player, he was too busy to write songs, he says, but he was always happy to demo songs of mine. So I'd have to sit there and write songs myself, which I hadn't done before, and I just thought, how embarrassing. I can't write a song, it's not that difficult. Just take four chords and put something on them. So when I was lying in the bath that night, when I was listening to the demo he did of Come Down, I realised that, well, look, you're not going to have a massive career, but the good news is that you're not in a terrible band. You're in a really good band. These songs are really good. And you're going to go out in flames at the Mean Fiddler and and just have a life where you make a cool record and you have a really small audience and you will get an Enemy and you will get a Melody Maker because this is really good stuff. And so it was like this anti-commercial moment where I felt like I was trying to understand what people would like, what
so
would make me successful.
So it frees you up, really. All of a sudden, you are untethered from the expectation. Yeah. Actually, I can just do this.
I've been failing for so long, and through that failure, I had all the labels that knew me in London. I was just second-guessing myself the whole time. Because, you know, when you fail or when you get rejected, rejection sounds like someone actually is an active process. No, you get ignored. You know what I mean? You get, like, the original ghosting was when you send demos in and you'd never hear from them again. Until, like, 6 months later, you'd be like, can I get some three more days in a studio? So, yeah, it was a liberating time because I'd been trying to understand that commercial route. And ironically, the first time I stopped doing that was the time that I found for 16 Stone was that record, because that's quite a new band. So it's like I wrote for 8 months, then we did a bit of a rehearsal, got my friend playing drums with us just to help us out, see what it was like, and it just felt better than anything I'd done. That's all. But I didn't mean to say that I thought anything would happen with it. I just knew I respected myself more. I sort of liked myself better for it.
Yeah, they're always missing legendary bands. The legend is the 16 Stone was kind of done and then just like parked, put on a shelf somewhere. Is that actually true? That
yeah. Didn't get well, what happened really? I signed to an independent label in the Valley in California, we had a distribution deal, and that one of the guys who signed us to Hollywood Records, which was a division of Disney, he died in a helicopter crash. So all the stuff on his desk, whatever, was then being reviewed by the subsequent team. And apparently, according to the folklore, according to the head of the label, that when he went in, they took the CD and they said, not only are there no singles on this album, there's no album tracks, and they threw it at him.
No, there's no singles and there's no album tracks.
Yeah.
There is nothing.
There's literally, you didn't even need to bring a CD in, just bring that box in. So that's what happened, is that when I had signed and I told everyone here, you know, yeah, I'm going to America, I was like, you don't do it, you're crazy. And I was like, I got no options. I said it quietly so no one would over, but I didn't have an option. Then when I went over there, they said, oh, we're going to meet the new label. And that was a new distributor. So I went there. That's when I met Ted Field and Jimmy Iovine from Interscope. And I was walked in like jaded. So what happened is when we got dropped or when they lost the deal, I did go back to work. And worked just down the road, just near Selfridges. I painted 11 dentist offices in Magnolia. So I went back to work. But you see, that fit into the narrative that I had when I was in the bath. I was like, makes perfect sense, of course, but you've made the record now, so at least that's happened.
Yeah.
You know, so it just fed into this sort of sense of not ever expecting much, really. Just sort of thought, well, you've made a record, at least you've done that. Because I was always working, I was always trying.
Yeah.
I was always writing, I was always like making an effort. It was just leading to where I was going. It wasn't really failing, because it's just a long trek.
Success that took a few years, but like, the record does break. Oh, this band had come out of nowhere. That first moment when it happens, when people, audiences get it, how did it feel for you? Was it vindication? Was it just relief when you're like, okay?
A little bit of both. I mean, you know, I began to get a bit worried about it. I was sort of young and cavalier and just lived my life and just thought, well, if it's not today, maybe it's tomorrow. You know, in terms of my spirit about it all, it wasn't like I wasn't beaten by it. You get disappointed and you dust yourself off. But, you know, there are no accidents, and people, because the other one is you have to have people that are prepared to, like, give their lives away. Mm. I mean, the sacrifice that all of us musicians make to be traveling, to be away, got to tell you, there's a toll.
Especially in the States. I mean, Britain's big, Europe's big. If you're going to commit to cracking through in America, there's a lot more.
I hadn't realised that, you know, like I literally hadn't thought that through. I was literally too dumb to consider that a tour, because I would have thought a tour was like England and a tour was like maybe you'd touch a couple of things in Europe. I didn't realise what it was, you know, like now you're on tour for 2 years.
and it is actually like that.
My mum passed away in January and I was at her funeral and I was watching these lovely footage of her life, you know, and everyone's in there, all the people, that special people in her life and this and that. And I noticed that every time I was with her in the pictures, it was at a restaurant or a house. Everyone else was at parties, at birthdays, at this, that. And I was like, wow. I had never really thought about it like that, but it really smacked me in the face when I saw that. I wanted to go to all those parties. I just was like, wow, I miss so much.
Let's do another musician that I know that you love. Let's touch on Nick Cave.
Oh, yeah.
What Nick Cave track should we play, and when did you first fall in love with the goth father?
Well, you know, Birthday Party, just when he was wild. You know, I like Warren Ellis. You know, I like all that scene. PJ Harvey, the Warren Ellis, Dirty Three, Nick Cave, Bad Seeds. And I just like the staggering creativity. Talking of North Stars, he's just fun to ponder and sort of think about his, you know, from the songs, from either band, from, what's his side project called, the band?
Grinderman.
Oh, God, those Grinderman records were ridiculous. So I just love all that he stands for and that mad creativity.
Is there a track we should play?
Well, Grinderman would be great. Get it on.
I've got to get up to get down and start all over again. Head on down to the basement and shout, kick those white mice and black dogs out. Kick those white mice and baboons out. Kick those baboons and other out and get it on. Get it on the day that you got born. They had to dig him from the ground. They chipped him from the frozen snow. They dug his monkey fingers, but he had nowhere to go. They dug his pink hair curlers. They dug his sequin gown. They dug his Stratocaster. They dug his pornographic crown.
He's got some words of wisdom.
I got some words of wisdom.
He's got some words of wisdom.
I got some words of wisdom. Get it on. Get it on. On the day. Crawled out of the ooze. He defied evolution. He had green flippers and sang the blues. He caused a revolution. I got in the British weeklies. He got in the dailies too. He drank panther piss and puffed the girls you're probably married to.
He's got some words of wisdom.
I got some words of wisdom.
He's got some words of wisdom.
He got some words of wisdom. Get it.
I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about fame, about musicians and fame, and she described the kind of how it is to break and become famous, especially as a musician, and she said, everyone's always waiting for you to turn up. And I thought, that's an interesting way of putting it. It's like, nothing happens until that person arrives at the gig, at the party, at the restaurant, at the thing. Everyone is waiting for you. And when it really, really broke big with you, you became that person. No matter how many barriers you put up or characters you play, nothing's going to prepare you for being the person that everyone's waiting for. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's why people choose to be singers, though, isn't it? They want that. And so in a funny way, to be successful feels more natural than to have been ignored and to be sort of on the sidelines. You know, I like being that person that, you know, the gig can't happen. Like I bust my knee doing shows or something like that. And then I was like, I went to get it fixed and just I had a shot in it. You know, you get these like a shot in there and I was like, there's a whole organization on this knee. If we lose this knee, if this knee needs 3 weeks off, I don't know what to do.
People's jobs.
A lot of people. So I think it's much funnier to think of it that it's all dependent on my knee showing up.
Were you good at it, do you think? Do you think you found ways of surviving that?
Well, the thing is that we all came up together, the four of us in the band. So I think that your band keeps you grounded. We went through so much together, playing all those clubs and you just build up that metal. So therefore, we kept each other grounded. And then the most impressive people I've ever met are just so much easier going, you know? And so they handle that fame by just being gracious and just being open. And I would imagine that Nick Cave is as fun as meeting Tom Waits, is as fun as meeting David Bowie. Whereas when you got the ones like halfway down the bill, do you know what I mean? Then the artifice, then the bravado, then the ego. So to me, the worse someone behaves is sort of, except for the divas who sort of, they blaze a trail we know not about. But the regular people in regular bands, you know, if they're stuck up, I usually think that probably means the record's not that strong.
Let's do another artist. Where should we go? Let's do Prince, because you spent a bit of time with him.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed him as well. He's the best smelling man I ever met. He smelled fun. Did you have a similar thing? Did you get the smell of Prince? I remember being particularly
He didn't. What's so great about him, again, I suppose it's a bit like those other guys, he did have this incredible aura, but he wanted to talk. He's really engaging and really present. One of the greats of all time, and so incredible watching him in the studio, watching him, how he was working. Just Paisley Park. I was surprised it wasn't a bit more tricked out, the studio. So it was more normal than I was expecting. But he did have this amazing, because he played in the warehouse. So you do shows in the warehouse, and then you have this sort of like holding area for after the show. It wasn't like a bedroom. It's just this sort of large room where he just would hold court. I only went there once, the Paisley Park, where that night he held court and went up there, and it's like Ella Fitzgerald is playing quietly in the corner and he's talking about the show, and it's like it's 5 a.m. because he's been playing Sly and the Family Stone since 1 a.m. you know, like I wanted to go home so bad. I was just like, you know, it's like 5 a.m. I was like, you know,
if I was your girlfriend, would you remember? Tell me all the things you forgot when I was your man. Hey, hey, when I was your man. If I was your best friend, would you let me take care of you and do all the things that only a best friend can? Oh, only best friends can.
So when Bush comes to an end, the first time it comes to an end, from the outside it seemed like you just kind of powered through and there was a new band and there was other stuff happening. But I don't believe anyone that's worked that hard with, as you say, a group of individuals and built up that chemistry. Did you mourn that thing? Now you can look back on it and go, okay, now with a bit of distance.
Well, I know what happened. What happened was I saw lots of people doing side projects. Again, going back to that sort of desire to be on a sort of Matador or 4AD where, you know, people go off and do a side project and do a record for 2 weeks, play it once, and they're done. You're like, wow, you know, like Grindr Man or something.
Yeah.
So for whatever reason, I just thought it was a really display of creativity because the guys wanted a break. The guitar player, he felt he'd missed his first kid growing up. So he said, I need a break. Let me take a year off and you can do a side project. You want to do that? So I said, okay. So I did that. Thing is, I was on Interscope with Jimmy Iovine and they torture you with, I nicknamed it Jimmy Jail, which is, Jimmy Jail is where he put every artist through, and they still do it now. Everyone does it. And I think Jimmy began it and I coined that phrase. And what Jimmy Jail is you'll work hard at a record, just get over the finish line, hand the record, and they'll say, go on, two more songs. I think we can do two more songs. I don't think we've got the one, you know. And I spent the next 2 years doing that for this side project. I was like losing my mind. So I spent 3 years on the side project, Institute. The record was brilliant. I did it with, I mean, I say that myself, but it's like I'm not in that band. I'm so proud of it. And Paige Hamilton produced it. It's a really cool record. Then I brought out a single. I did it with Fotek, Bulletproof Skin, and it was really cool. And then they said, there's no other songs on there. You have to do, no, we want you to do a solo record now. And we'd been on tour for 2 months. I'd written for 3 years.
Whoa.
I was like, oh my God. So then I went back to the boys and I said, you want to do a Bush record? And they said, no, I still like, no, really enjoying being at home. Then my ego got the better of me because nobody wants what I did next. The old solo record from someone in a band. Nobody wants it. I was like, what was I doing? Why did I? And it was because they didn't want to play. And I'd been a bit seduced by seeing someone I was with having a great solo career. And I was thinking, that's the way to go. It's really fun. That's so fun. And so I did a record. I had a big success with it. But I just felt fraudulent, and every night I'd go on tour, I'd play a show, people were like, where's the band, you know? So I had a hit on Hot AC, which is a different sort of radio thing, because they brought out the ballad. I was like, you bring out the ballad first, that's why you do that to me. So they brought out the ballad, and everyone likes a weepy ballad, so the weepy ballad did its job. It's a pretty song, Love Remains the Same.
Half the time the world is ending, truth is I am done pretending. Any more to
But when I went to the shows, so the people would be showing up, like, new people going, that ballad's really pretty. Then I'd be playing all the kind of other rock stuff. And then people that showed up from Bush didn't want me to really be doing that. So I was sort of tortured for 2 months and toured it. I didn't like, that was when it was weird, being at the front, my name on the radio. That I didn't like that. I liked being Bush. Oh, it just felt so weird. And like, that's where I felt really, oh my God, it's so embarrassing. And that's when you really are the one. And I didn't like that feeling. 2 months into that tour, I then said I knew I didn't want to get dropped from Interscope. So I called Jimmy up and I said, look, because they wanted me to do another solo record. And I was like, no. I recorded a bit with Pharrell.
Really?
Yeah, how's I got that? Some three tracks. It was great fun. And on Friday, Jimmy loved it. I was going to do the whole record with him. By Monday morning, we had a meeting and the whole thing was off. So something had happened on the weekend. You know, I have the songs. I should just leak them because, I mean, why not? They're pretty good songs, three really good songs. I had a good time with him. So I called Jimmy up and I said, I know you're not going to want this, so I'm leaving because I have to do my band. I didn't want him to have an awkward conversation with me because I sold him a lot of... I don't know. He may not have wanted to drop me, but I think it just was like... And that's when I restarted Bush in 2010. So it'd been like sort of 6 years... But the thing was, is that that was the end of the old band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was weird because life is like that. And there are no accidents, like I said. And that was the way that suddenly that guitar player joined us in 2002. Chris was with me through the solo career. And Corey was with me in the solo career. We got Robin, the drummer from Bush. The new Bush was that. That's what we needed to do. I needed the fire and the blood of some different people. And Nigel was never wanted to come back. He just had retired. So no one got fired or anything like that. It was very English and very sort of
very
decent.
Restrained.
Yeah, really decent. Just didn't make him happy. And it wasn't what he wanted to do. And it was all I wanted to do. So it was a really, really simple. Now that band I have since 2010, I like... so committed and so strong and so consistent every night. It's brilliant. You know, I'm really lucky to have them.
Well, this is where we are now, isn't it? When you do a greatest hits, for some bands, it's like, well, that's it now. We're done. But you've got to keep moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a new album. I guess that desire, as you say, I want to be in Bush. That's still as present.
Yeah, it's how, you know, this information... highway that we live in of like disinformation and disconnection. It's the most solid thing that I've had. You know, obviously I have my children, I have my songs, and the songs are best when they come out through Bush. I just keep it simple. It feels good to do that, and I don't feel tongue-tied, or it still feels really creative. And in a way, you know, as an artist, always trying to improve. And just, there's that great line that Alain de Botton says. He says, like, if you're not embarrassed of who you were last year, you're not working on yourself. And so whilst I'm not necessarily embarrassed, I mean, I did have a realization that was a little bit of time, maybe in 2010, maybe a bit before, there's this part of me that felt like it was maybe treading water a little bit. But I think that for me, it makes it feels more vital, more vibrant if I'm also doing new stuff. I don't forsake the other stuff that got me there. So, you know, when we play a set, it's loaded with songs people might know who know the band, and then with songs off the new record. But yeah, and it's fun. It's inspiring for the band to play something that's a bit different. I mean, we have a whole new record to play now. It's going to be intense.
And yeah, I've got that thing. And I speak to musicians. If they're lucky enough to have one or two or three of those songs, you know, the ones... And nearly all of them have got that relationship where you're like, yeah, I loved it, then I wasn't sure, then, like, I actually quite enjoyed playing it again, I just want to back away from it. And, like, now we know, no matter what's happening, we've got that, we've got, like, Swallowed, we've got whatever in our arsenal, and we know that people are going to lose their minds because we can deliver it, and we can do it better than anyone else, and we can do it now. Right. And that becomes quite joyous at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Warm sun, feed me up and I'm weary. Load it up, loathing for a change, and I slip some boil away. Yeah.
you said you would love to try some. Here you said you would love to die some. In the middle of the world on a fish hook, you're the wave, you're the wave, you're the wave. Swallowed, borrowed, heavy about everything but my love. Swallowed, hollowed, shumbled about everyone but yourself.
Actually, was Swallowed, because I realised that's the hit song we have here. I did a reimagining of that because I was getting a bit, I felt like I played a certain way, so it's been fun to, I reimagined that song, gave it a kind of a remix whilst leaving the vocals alone. And that goes over really well in the shows. We just played it, and that's a really uplifting moment with voices, and it works really good. I think that it's really healthy to think of shows in the way that what you love to go and see as a punter, you know. So there's loads of songs you know, and there's songs where you're just like impressed, like you know, Sleep Token was a new band for you, and they're staggering, you know, many staggering songs. So it's just, if people don't know it, we've gotten to a point now where I feel really confident that there's no weak song. There's maybe a song you know less than another.
I was going to ask you about this before, but I want to ask you about Steve Albini.
Oh, yeah.
Because I didn't realise that when you worked with him, it was Abbey Road, wasn't
yeah.
it? Which I think is like the most, I can't imagine Steve Albini in Abbey Road. They seem like two very, very different creative forces.
Except with the best mic collection. So it's just, I think it's the history, the literal audio history. And the technology, as in the microphones, the compressors, the delays, the actual desks. They've got Studio 2 where we recorded, there's the original, was a reverb chamber. What's so funny is that actually Studio 2 where we worked, there's a funny tiny little control room, and then you look down into the main floor. But yeah, working with him there was incredible. I remember stuff like, mostly when you make records, you do tracking, so you put down a guide guitar, the guide vocal, then you start putting guide stuff on, and you replace everything through, you know, and you can play together. But when I was playing one song there, and there was a string section coming, and I remember it's like, I put the track down before they get there, you know. He looked at me like I was from Mars. So he made me, you know, made me play with them. He was just about in of the moment. He was all about the moment and everyone playing together. I had this image of him, because he made quick records, I thought he'd be running around the studio, plugging things in like he was on fire. And he's quite sort of languid and just doing his thing and miking stuff up. So I just had a great time with him, great memories with him. And like all great lessons, I had wanted to go and do another record with him where I would go and take a bunch of the hit songs and reimagine them with him. I always wanted to do an atmospherics album with him and never did. And it's a good lesson in like, just do stuff. Do stuff.
And the final question, what's the final song that we should play? What should we go out on? It can be something of yours, something of someone else's, something you've loved for years, or something you heard this morning. What's the final song we should play on the show?
I want to play Scars by Bush off of the new record.
Why that song?
Because it opens the record, and I think this is really important, how you open a record and what you set your intention, you set the tone, and people kind of know if they want to go any further or not. It's really inclusive, and this record is really about people's struggles and challenges, only because I've looked at it through my own lens of life and stuff, and just people struggling a lot out there, you know, in this very modern world where people just can get so isolated and be so dwarfed by other people's alleged achievements and ostentation, lifestyles. And there's always a sense that other people are living a better life than you. Social media is really antisocial, isn't it? Because it's really like based on the fact that just have a look at someone while you're living a humdrum life who's living a way better life than you. You know, I look at them like, I need to get away more. No one invites me to a yacht party. You know, what is this? So I think that you know, when I first made these records, what we were talking about earlier, you know, there's no horizon. There's like, there's no even no corners. I didn't know what was happening, what was anywhere going to happen. So it sort of really tried to make a record that was really personal, that people could relate to, that wasn't based on an incredible lifestyle. It's based on an incredible truth that, wow, it's kind of challenging at times, isn't it?
Then that's the song we should finish on. It's been good to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been so fun to be here. I'm at BBC Radio. Who knew?
What's on your mind? What's in the mirror? Who do you see? Who do you love? Are you able? Are you willing to let yourself shine on through? Tell me all your paranoias. Tell me what hurts the most. Sorry for the phone lines. Sorry for the sea of ghosts. Stars are angels written on your body. I forget slowly. Sweet despair, lonely pain is a focus for release. I'm sick inside, and sometimes outside. The body is quite complex. The head is split in four directions. I should know which way is best. I wrap you in my broken arms. And all I got, they'll have to do is memories and trigger stations, panic buttons and super glue. Stars are angels written on your body. Slowly forget lost. Forbidden fruit brings sweet despair. Lonely pain is a focus for release.
That was Scars by Bush from their most recent album, I Beat Loneliness. And thank you to my guest on the first time today from Bush, Gavin Rossdale. And that is the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with a brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be the wonderful Yasmin Lacey. Of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from this series, featuring Imogen Heap and Rat Scabies of The Damned, and shows from the archive, including my conversations with Self Esteem, Florence Welsh, Tom York, and the late, great Jimmy Cliff. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
Next music.